So we'll get started again. Just a couple reminders. You should be sure to make sure that you've signed in on the sign-up sheet. For those who came late this morning, be sure to look at the course page and the lecture notes for the rules about grading. So hopefully all of you will get high grades and won't force me to give you low grades. The question came up about the length of the report. As you can have one, two, or three people in a group, the maximum length scales up if there are more people in the group. So if there are two people in the group, you can have a maximum of 20 pages. That doesn't mean you must have 20 pages. It just means you have a maximum of 20 pages. If you have 12 wonderful pages and it's two people, don't worry about it. It's not a problem. Length isn't the object. The reason actually for setting it at 10 pages is the fact that it's very hard to do short, good papers. I've often spent weeks of time to take something that, say, started out as a conference paper to get it short enough to actually fit in 6 pages or 8 pages. And that's very hard. You don't need to work at that. You need to focus on the content. And that's why I set a much more liberal 10 pages per person. Okay, so we'll begin where we left off this morning, talking about mobility management protocols. We said that we needed to have a way so that users could move from cell to cell, perhaps even from network to network, and we needed to be able to find them, and we needed to be able to maintain the communication. So there are 3 major protocols today that are used for this. One of them is mobile IP, which you should all be familiar with. The other one is an CIA interim standard 41, called IS41 or NC41. And the one we will look at most is the Global System for Mobile Communications, GSM Mobile Application Part, called MAC. But first we need to understand that mobility can be split into 2 different categories. The first of these is macro mobility. This is moving between domains, where a domain is one administrative content. So moving from one operator to another operator, moving one kind of network to another kind of network. And the other is micromobility. Now, micromobility is really very, very interesting. The most interesting part about micromobility is nobody outside of the current domain has to know about micromobility. Right? Because from your point of view, you're still contactable at the same domain. So micromobility can be managed inside the domain however it wants to do this. But macromobility becomes an issue because everyone has to figure out, if you've moved from one network, how to find the network where you are. So, first issue is getting service. Once a mobile's identity is known, the first question, and it's a policy question, is should this mobile get service? Okay? This is a policy question, right? Should this particular mobile terminal get service? And that's a question about roaming agreements, and these are typically reciprocal agreements. I'll let your users migrate to my network if you let my users migrate to your network. The current traffic load. We could say, yes, normally we would let you move, but we're all full up now. We don't have any more capacity, so you can't move. Anticipated traffic loads. Oops, it's coming near 5 o'clock on Friday. Everybody's headed on this section of the E4. No, we can't take any more subscriber terminals now. And even the mobile user's priority or class. So I had a colleague some time ago who one weekend was sailing and oops, out of his pocket fell his GSM phone. On Monday, his operator called him up and said, Lars, we're sending you a new phone. And he said, why? They said, well, we noticed you didn't make any calls for the last 24 hours, and this is so unlike you that you must have lost your phone, so we're sending you a new phone and new SIM card. Why? Because he made about something like 20,000 krona calls a month. He lived on his phone. He was a salesperson. Okay? So for operators, these high-priority customers, you want to make sure to give them service. If they would have gotten more business out of him by sending him two or three phones, they would have happily sent him two or three phones. Okay? So different users have different priorities. And it may even affect what priority they get when their network is busy. So do I let a user who rarely ever makes a call have service over one of my customers who's one of my best customers? Well, too bad for the infrequent customer like me. All right, now there's a very nice thesis by Juan Caballero Bayari and Daniel Malmquist looking at network access for public WAN. I have three students this past year. One is completed, two will soon complete, who've been looking at alternatives to IEEE 802.1X, which is a protocol that is widely used to decide, should I allow a terminal access to a wireless LAN network? And the basic problem is, as we'll see later when we talk about it, this makes the assumption that the user shouldn't be given service. And my conjecture, which is the basis of these three theses, is in fact, no, most of the time the user should get service. It's only some of the time the user is going to be not a valid user. So therefore, you should optimize for the case that occurs most often, not for the case that occurs rarely. Okay, so if a user comes along, we can find out, yes, should we give them service or not? Another problem is, if a call arrives for a user, how do we find the user? Well, one of the methods is we can track the user continuously. We can keep track of where the user is at all times. We can also, instead of tracking them, we can just say, well, they were last seen in this area, and start looking there and search out in an increasing scope until we find them. We can guess where they might be. We can say, ah, it's Thursday, the 29th of January. I see by his schedule that he's in Aulu. Okay, so we could use that information. Personal schedules, past patterns of movement, etc. We could have the user tell us. So we could, according to some schedule, the user could say, hey, here's where I am. We can have the user listen for something, such as a page. So if they hear the page, they check in. And we can have the user tell an intermediary. So we can have the user tell their agent. And now if we want to know where the user is, we contact their agent. And this is a particularly interesting situation because, of course, the user preserves their location privacy. Only their agent knows where they are and how to reach them now. And so, for instance, SIP systems can use this approach. Now, why all these different varieties? What are the advantages and disadvantages of them? Okay, so what's the advantage of tracking the user continuously? You always know where they are, right? Sounds great. You can immediately deliver the call. What's the problem with tracking the user continuously? Yes. Yes, so cost, energy. What else? So we have overhead. We have to spend part of our network resources tracking this user. What else? Yes. Yes. So we have a problem about whether it's an ethical issue or whether it's a legal issue about continuously tracking the user. So, for instance, in both Sweden and Finland, it requires a court order for an operator to give out your location, unless you in writing have agreed that your location can be given out and you identify who it can be given to. That means even the police saying, hey, we want to know this user's location. They can't get it. They have to have a court order. And many years ago, I think 5 of the top people at Sonera in Finland were arrested because they used the information about the location of a subscriber without the subscriber's permission. Why did they do that? Well, there were some ugly reports they thought that appeared in the local paper, and they figured it was someone leaking from inside. So what did they do? They took their list of employees, searched down for those employees, found out where they were, looked at the numbers they were calling, and aha, they saw that it was someone calling from inside their premises to this particular number at one of the Helsinki papers. And the result is they figured out who was squealing. The bad problem is they all ended up going to prison because what they did was illegal. So location is a very sensitive issue today. But the major problem is actually just the cost, particularly as most users aren't contacted all of the time. So spending lots of resources, particularly if it requires network resources and the user dislikes it, it costs them battery life, is a problem. Now, there are some people, such as myself, who believe that the only safe state for a cellular phone is the same state that a Windows operating system should be kept in, and that's, of course, turned off, right? And the advantage is you can't be tracked. Of course, the other issue is you can't be reached either, all right? So there are many people who take advantage of paging in combination with mobile communication to say, okay, I will listen for a page, and when I get a page from someone that I'm interested in having them reach me now, wherever I am, then I will turn my phone on, and I will register, and now I will be able to communicate. And this works because, in general, pages are sent over a very, very large area. And because the user can say, do I want to reveal my location or not? And so the user has control over, do they disclose their location? But location turns out to be a very mixed area, in part because it turns out the location systems actually don't work very well. And that's been an issue. So the next issue is handoff management detection assignment. The first problem is who initiates the handoff? Is it the mobile device or the network? The next is how can you detect that you should do a handoff? And then what's the difference between handoff and handover? And handover is largely described here in Europe and handoff in North America. Since I'm from North America, please forgive me for constantly referring to it as a handoff. You can mentally translate that to handover. So this handoff handover, or if you're a real telecom geek, you will call it an automatic link transfer, is the process by which a mobile is handed over from one access point to another. Now, there are a whole variety of different sorts of handoffs. We can have so-called soft handoffs. In soft handoffs, the mobile can communicate with both of the access points at the same time. Okay? So if this little base station over here is one base station, the one I'm currently using, and this one over here is the one I'm going to be using, as I would move along, I'd be able to communicate with both of them. Okay? So I never am in a position of not having connectivity. That's great. The opposite is a hard handoff. And here what happens is at some point I lose connectivity, and then I look around and say, ah, and then I connect. So there's a period of time when I don't have connectivity. And this could be on the uplink, the downlink, or both. Now, if I'm lucky, I have seamless handoff, and this means that neither the user nor the applications notice the handoff, i.e. there's no effect on the content of the stream. Now, the advantage here is if we have smooth handoff, or if we'll see something called fast handoff, we don't notice it. Okay, so if I switch from one to the other, and yes, there's a period of time when I don't have connectivity, but it's very short, and I don't notice it, do I care? No. a glitchless handoff. In this case, the delay can be hidden or eliminated from the data stream. That means there is some loss, but we cover it up. We can have a smooth handoff. So in this case, we buffer the traffic. So at the point that we actually hand over, then we get the buffered traffic. Fast handoff, only a very short interruption. The next two are an important pair, so-called vertical handoff. And this is when the new cell is larger than the current cell. So if I walk out the front of the building, I might go from a small cell in the building to a large cell covering sheath bit. That's a vertical handoff in the upward direction. And we can, of course, have a vertical handoff in the downward direction, too. Versus horizontal handoff, when the cells are basically the same type and same size. Now, typically, if we move around between cells in a wireless LAN, those are horizontal handoffs. We go from one cell to another cell to another cell. No problem. So it's usually vertical handoffs that are our big challenge, because they're quite often, they're handoffs between different systems, and therefore we have to deal with the two different systems, the mobility between the two, and the path even between the two may be very, very different. Whereas typically in horizontal handoffs, there isn't a big change in the delay, there isn't necessarily a big change in the path. Okay, so handoff criteria. How do we know when to hand off? Well, we could do it based on signal quality. So we could say as we're moving along, the signal strength drops. And so when it gets to a certain point, we want to start looking for our new base station or access point, right? Things are not bad yet, but they're starting to look bad. At some point, the signal quality has fallen a lot, and we should start to switch. The goal is that we'll switch before we reach our minimum threshold, right? Before we actually lose connectivity. Why do we want to switch before then? Right? Because we don't want interruption in our data streams. What else? We still have connectivity to talk about what we're doing, right? After we've lost connectivity, we have no way of even telling the system, hey, I'm moving over to here, because, unfortunately, we lost connectivity. Because at some point, we reached across this threshold, and now, if we didn't manage to accomplish our handoff before then, in the case of voice systems, the call is terminated, because you can't be reached anymore. We can also look at data quality. And so in this case, we're actually going to look not at the link properties, but we're going to look at the properties at a higher layer, saying, okay, rather than pure signal strength, we may look at how many errors are they, and are the errors sufficiently great that we can't correct for them? Okay, so how many of you listen to physical CDs? Anyone still here? I know they're very old-fashioned. Okay, so what's one of the properties that you like about listening to a physical CD?
I can listen to them like really detailed music, which I cannot listen to the industry.
Okay, so one of the big advantages is it has a much bigger dynamic range. It's a 15-bit dynamic range, right? So that's 6 dB per bit. That means you can go from the quietest little piccolo to the crashing cymbals, and you can hear all of this detail. It's very hard to hear in an MP3. What's another difference between listening to that CD and listening to a vinyl album? Yes. You can do that too in a vinyl album. You lift the arm up, you move it over, and you lower it down. What else? Yes. Okay, so the quality is very different because it's actually a digital recording. And one of the most important parts about it is the fact that if I touch the CD even, there's a very small probability that there's going to be an error. Why? Because they use very, very strong block coding. right? So I rarely ever hear an error when I listen to a CD, right? But if I listen to a vinyl album, unless I've been very, very careful, and it's one of the first Deutsche Grammophon pressings and so forth, I will hear errors. Lots and lots of recovery techniques are available today, so quite often, even though things are bad, it's not affecting the user communication at all because you've corrected for those errors. The problem is, we're so good at correcting those errors that by the time you notice, oops, you're really in trouble. All right? So today, people are trying to understand how much do we use the signal quality and how much do we use the data quality to make our decision about when do we do the handoff. Because bad as things may be, if we actually still have sufficient signal-noise ratio to be able to correct all of our packets, maybe we don't want to hand off. Because the new cell we might hand off might be very heavily utilized and will actually have poorer connectivity than we do with the one that we have a weak signal from. Okay, so the problem about when to do the handoff and who to hand off to is really complex. And that's why we have a variety of goals. We may look at minimum impact. We want to do the handoff at just the right time. So in voice systems, that might be between speech bursts. Because then we do the handoff and nobody notices. We might consider the tolerance or adaptation for congestion and capacity reasons. So now we make the handoff because, gee, this other cell is light for utilization, right? So we actually may get lower loss rate or higher throughput or something like that. We may do it for efficiency reasons. We may do it to improve availability because we get better bandwidth, lower cost, lower delay variance, etc. Now, ideally, the mobile ought to be able to use the maximum set of access points that are available. However, that may mean you have to change the spreading code, change the modulation code, change your coding, or even change to a different radio module. But if you can do that, you can reach a better system optima. And so today, in the extreme, is something called cognitive radio, which one of my former doctoral students, Joe Mitola, invented in his dissertation 10 years ago. And these are radios that utilize software-defined radios to completely change what kind of radio they are so that they're the right kind of radio for the current use. So the right kind of radio at the right time. Maximum flexibility. However, there's a big problem in terms of energy costs today. However, for base stations, it may work out very, very well. So anyone here ever hear of a company called Bose, B-O-S-E? Yes? Yes, that's his father. So Bose of Bose speakers, his son, Vanu Bose, has a company that builds multi-radio using software-defined radios, base stations today. And the advantage is he builds base stations out of PCs. And the result is the cost is incredibly low. And because it's only software, you can load in different software and have it be a different kind of base station. So this is an incredibly hot area today. But back to this decision about when to make the decision. The goal is you want to decide it before you need it, so that there's still time to do something. So you actually have to start anticipating when is the time to switch. And so there's a threshold for looking, and there's a threshold for handing off. Okay, so at some point I start to say, hey, the signal's starting to get weak. It's time to look around and see if there's a better access point. Right, because now I have time to make a decision. If I don't do anything until I get no longer connected, then I'm in trouble because now I have to do it in a panic. Otherwise, I start losing traffic. Unfortunately, reality is even more complex. The reason is that there's so-called Raleigh fading, fast fading, slow fading. There are different kinds of indicators that we can have. i.e. feedback to tell us about errors, word errors, or received signal strength, or signal quality indicators, etc. So actually doing handoff well is an amazingly complex issue. Fortunately, we mostly don't have to worry about it. We just have to know that handoff's going to occur. Somehow we're going to learn about it, and we're going to make our decisions. And mostly the algorithms we're going to use to make decisions, people have already worked out. But some of these are important to understand the basic ideas. And typically with received signal strength indication, we use leaky buckets and window averaging to say, well, yes, this packet was a little bit weak, but the next one wasn't so bad. So, hey, maybe I'll continue using the access point that I've been using, right? So to compute much more powerful statistical measures of is it a good channel or not, versus just, oh, the current received signal strength isn't very good. Today, lots of techniques exist to try to improve things, like diversity techniques. That frequency is bad, so it shifts to another one. And GSM, for instance, does this at a rather fast rate, about four times a second or something like that. If you use Bluetooth systems, they hop at 1,600 times per second. So they change the frequency that's being used extremely quickly. And you can use various signal processing techniques. The bad problem is most of these techniques have unpleasant effects on the higher layer traffic, such as if you use interleaving, which GPRS uses, it increases the delays. And unfortunately, in GPRS, this led to the fact that GPRS was unusable for interactive voice because the delays were too high. So who makes the decision? Well, we can have the network control the handoff, called network-controlled handoff. We can have mobile-assisted handoff, where the mobile makes measurements, sends them to the network, and now based on that information, the network makes the decision. And we can have mobile-controlled handoff. And that's used, for instance, in DEX packs and mobile IP. We can also have forward handoff, where the mobile initiates the handoff and sends the request to the new access point, or backward handoff, where the mobile initiates the handoff but sends the request to the old access point. Now, what's the advantage of sending a message to your old access point? You already have connectivity with them. You've already proved who you are. You've authenticated. You're authorized. You're getting service. What's the problem about the new access point? It doesn't know me yet. It doesn't know if it should be providing me service, right? The other problem is in mobility, all my packets, if it's data packets, are going to my old access point. Right? So if I show up at the new access point, what happens? Well, my traffic's still going to the old access point, and it's going to take some time to get it redirected. Whereas if I send the message to my old access point, say, hey, I'm going to be moving to this new access point, start redirecting the traffic there, then what happens when I arrive at the new access point? Boom. I'm getting all of my traffic right away. So Jiang Wu did a thesis for his licentiate a couple of years ago, where he said, even for multicast traffic, if I can send through my existing communication link information about the network I'm going to go into, I can move to even another network and continue to receive my multicast without interruption, because I get my agent in the new network to register for me. So the traffic starts flowing already to the new access point before I ever arrive, right? And the result is that you could actually get the effect of a smooth handoff, even though there was no smooth handoff in the case where you're receiving multicast traffic. That clear to everybody? Okay. Next, we'll talk about inter base station handoff, also known as inter-cell handoff. So in this case, the mobile is going to move from using this access point and this cell to this access point. So at some point, this path is going to be replaced with that path. And classically, in mobile telephony systems, what happens is the mobile switching center starts replicating the traffic and sending it to both access points. And then what happens is, when the mobile arrives here, it sends now a message saying, okay, I don't need to have it sent to access point one anymore, and you chop this off, and now you just have that path. Right, the advantage is, from the user's point of view, if I move from one cell to the other, there's no loss, right? Because it's the same whether I get it from that access point or whether I get it from that. That's the copying here. What's the problem from the operator's point of view? Okay, so there's a problem about management, but more fundamentally. Okay, so we have to duplicate the traffic. So that costs us something in the MSC. What else? The problem is, the mobile's already here. The mobile's not there, but we're still sending that traffic out in that cell. We're wasting capacity, right? Because we can't have another user using that time channel or the frequency or the code, because we're still using it for the old user who's not there anymore, right? Like burning money. Okay, so this is a hard problem for operators, particularly when they need the resources. And it's when we're short of resources that things get complex. Now, everyone hopefully understands that if there are plenty of resources, then life is easy, right? If you're rich, life is easy, right? So, the problem here is the fact that a non-prioritized user moves into the cell. There aren't resources. What can we do? Well, we actually have to block the handover. You can say, sorry, can't take you. Unfortunately, meanwhile, I cut off my communication with my previous access point, expecting I was going to get communication from the new access point. Oops. We have a link failure. And quite often that means the call gets terminated. So to reduce forced terminations, so-called improved call completion statistics, we can think about reserving the channel. So we keep a little bit of extra capacity available in every cell so that new users can arrive. We can think about priority-based queuing, and another technique, which is really very sophisticated, the so-called subrating technique, and that means that one of the existing users in my new cell gets reduced in quality, base bandwidth gets reduced, so that the part that they were using can be used by me, the new user. Okay, so they might go from a full-rate voice codec to half-rate voice codec, so their voice quality decreases a little bit, but that gives enough that I should come and migrate with half voice rate quality. Now, that other user may be unhappy because they just lost part of their quality. So what can we do to try to keep the users happy? We only do this to our bad customers, right? We don't do that to our best customers. Our bad customers who didn't pay us very much money, well, what do we care about them anyhow, right? And that might be one scheme in terms of prioritizing your different users. Another scheme is, instead, you randomize who the user is that you're taking bandwidth away from right now. So you lower, on average, the quality, but therefore each user doesn't notice it very much. And if you're really good at doing this, you do it when they're not using the channel, the pauses between the words, and then they don't notice at all. Okay, so that's got us moving between base stations in one system. What happens when we move between systems? So an inter-system handoff or an inter-MSC handoff. Now we actually have to establish that trunk between the two mobile switching centers, so as the user moves from this network controlled by this base station controller to this portion of the network controlled by that base station controller, the traffic gets delivered to the right switching center. Now, how often do you think we need to do this? Is this likely to happen or not likely to happen? Okay, he says it's likely to happen. So everyone who thinks it's likely to happen, raise your left hand. Okay, a couple. How many think it's unlikely to happen? Raise your right hand. All right. Now, for those of you who think it's unlikely to happen, consider what happens if you are in a sailboat and you're sailing on the west coast of Sweden. Everyone knows where the west coast of Sweden is, right? That way. Okay, what happens as you're sailing along? Well, you sail along in this way because it's really good wind, and then you tack the other direction. And guess what happens whenever you sailed along in this direction? Yes, your mobile handset hands off to the Danish operator. And what happens when you tack back in the other direction? Yes, the mobile handset hands off to the Swedish operator. Every one of those generates a billing record. Those are inter-system handoffs. Now, does anyone know where you experience mobile switching center handoffs frequently? This is, of course, a trick question for those of you who know German politics. Yes, if you drive along the region that used to be the border between the eastern and western parts of Germany, you will experience lots of inner MSC handoffs because the networks were built out at different times when the wall still existed, and the result is the MSCs in one area are connected, the base stations in one area connected to one MSC, and the area to its east, those MSCs are all installed later, and the base stations are all installed later, so those base stations all connect to another MSC, and if you drive along the right areas, you'll hand off back and forth between these two MSCs. Okay, so these are two horror tales of when it can occur frequently. So it can occur frequently. The good news is it doesn't very often occur frequently. What's the problem with this? Well, the problem is that when the user moved, we had to establish this trunk to another MSC. That was all fine. Now what happens when the user tacked and went back? Well, gee, do we take all the traffic here, tunnel it back? What happens when they move to a third MSC? Do we keep establishing these tunnels? And these tunnels are rather expensive in the infrastructure to do. Well, yes, but then we go and we minimize by chopping out the paths we don't need. All of this requires a lot of signaling communication in the operator's network, and that takes resources. Now, the hardest problem, of course, in all of this isn't just that it takes bandwidth. If one looks in detail, the difficulty is the dimensioning of the signaling in these networks, because these are built out of the same kind of switches, if you're using Ericsson equipment, as the traditional public switch telephony switches. They were never dimensioned to handle large amounts of signaling traffic. But, gee, you're forcing them to handle lots of signaling traffic. So there can be a problem there. Mobile IP has one interesting approach, and that is simultaneous bindings. So you can say, yes, I'm reachable by that access point, by this IP address, I'm reachable by that access point, by another IP address, and I'm reachable by yet another network, by another IP address, and they can all be valid at the same time. And now you force the work about sending which way do you send them to the endpoints, instead of the problem being handled by the network nodes. Yes. The result is that you can have incredibly fast handoff times, like less than 10 milliseconds. The big difference here is instead of break before make, where we lost connectivity before we have it, we make connectivity before the break occurs, and thus the interruption time can be very, very short. Next issue is roaming. Roaming is when we move from one operator's network to another. And as I said earlier, roaming is generally based on roaming agreements. These are basically agreements between operators. You service my users, and I'll service your users. But they were typically bilateral. That meant that an operator had to negotiate lots of these with all of the different parties that their customers might encounter. Now, a side effect is we have to do authentication authorization. In the new system, using the home system's mobility database. So there are a number of problems. When traffic arrives at the network for the user, what should we do? Should we forward it or direct it to the user's current location or not? Right? Because obviously, we have to get the data from the home network to decide, yes, we should provide connectivity to this user, and it's a guarantee that the home network's going to pay us for doing that. Okay. The problem, however, is when the user leaves this network and goes somewhere else, what's the home operator doing with all the traffic? Yes, they're sending it to this other operator. Right? But the subscriber isn't there anymore, but they don't know that. So they're still sending all the traffic there. Until the user comes back to the home network and says, hey, I'm home. Yes, it's a bizarre situation. So you're sending all of this traffic, you're sending all of this, and there's nobody there. So who's going to pay for it? Obviously, you're not there, so you didn't receive any of these calls or any of this traffic. But somebody has to pay. And that, of course, is going to be, yes, depending upon the bilateral agreement, whether it's the sender or whether it's the receiver. And amazingly enough, it's a big issue about should you redirect the traffic or not? When should the location change be reported? Who pays for all of that? And in fact, in some networks, there's even a charge for roaming. So if you're an AT&T customer, for instance, they make you pay every day that you're not in their network. And that's to pay for the fact that they're offering you roaming. And they're having to maintain the location of where to send your traffic when you're not in their network. Yes, it's a strange concept. And they make a lot of money doing this. Okay. So user roaming means that we now need to have a home location register, a database, in the home network, and a visitor location registry for all the network users who are visiting in our network, which keeps some of the data from their home network, and it keeps track of where they are in the visited network. And many years ago, I was in a dissertation defense in Norway discussing the problems about when do you age out the entries in these databases and how do you decide which ones you should remove. Now, why are these issues of concern if you're an operator? Well, the big problem is you may have tens of millions or hundreds of millions of users in these databases, and you're doing lots of transactions against them. And in some cases, one particular operator in Germany, it was their database that led to the limitations of the network's performance, not their capacity of their network. They just simply couldn't do enough database operations per second to keep everything up to date. And therefore, they were losing customers. The worst problem is there's another database not shown here, and that's the database containing all the billing records. And there they really couldn't keep up with the rate at which records were coming, and they had a lot of problems. Yes, so life is difficult when you can't even manage to keep track of the billing data. Of course, there are techniques to do this, like replicating and other database techniques, but all of that costs. So dimensioning those databases becomes important. As we said, roaming management, there are two parts. Registration. That means we update our location. So the mobile station is going to inform the system of its current location. And then the location tracking process, locating the user when it's time to deliver the call. And we mentioned the home location register and the visitor location register. So let's take a look here at our user, Gunvor, driving from Kiruna, visiting in Gothenburg, arriving in Stockholm. Now, as she's from Kiruna, her home location register is located in Corona. As she moves from one place to another, updates have to occur to the visitor location registry to authorize her to get service there. And as she moves between the two different visited ones, at some point, the data is going to get deleted out of the visitor location register, sent to another visitor location register, and in both cases, her home register has to be updated saying, hey, here's the current visitor, valid visitor location register, or this is the valid visitor location register. Why do we have to update the home location register? Because anyone who calls her, the indications based upon her subscriber number, direct all the calls to her home MSC. So if someone, after she has been visiting in Gothenburg, who was talking to her while she was in Gothenburg, calls her, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to see an entry in the visitor location register saying, yes, Gunvor is in Gothenburg. And then it's going to go to try to establish a call, and it's going to fail. It will find no response. So it's going to back up and go to the home location registry saying, okay, she's not here anymore. Where is she? And at that point, hopefully, it's been updated to know, yes, she's in Stockholm. Okay, so when you move, who do you update first? The home location registry or the visitor location registry? Right. So we have to update the visitor location registry first. And then, in turn, update the home location registry, telling it, hey, this is where we are. Now, there can be whole chains of this because, in fact, if there's lots of traffic between these two, they might actually have a communications path between them, right? So there's a high-speed train running from Gothenburg to Stockholm. Lots of users might do this. Instead of updating the home location registry later, we might update this visitor location registry knowing that that's where the user has moved into. We saw them moving through a series of cells. Hey, boom, they're headed to Stockholm. Update the VLR in Stockholm. Now, of course, it can't all be this simple. We can improve it a lot by using forwarding, so the result is when the updates happen, we actually put a forwarding entry saying, well, I don't know, but send it over to here. We can use implicit or periodic re-registration, so we can implicitly deregister. So we simply remove the records from the VLR when you need space, if they're not being used. And we can have a mobile periodically register, even though it's not going to make a call, just to keep the entry alive in the VLR. Right? Because if we don't keep the entry alive in the VLR, what happens? Well, it times out, it's deleted, and now everything has to go back to Corona. Now, do you think this matters? Well, the hard problem is, and there are two students who did a nice master's thesis on this about a year ago, that if you have, for instance, a set of people all on a cruise ship who are from different regions, and they call each other, if you don't use clever things like this, what happens? Yes, all the calls get sent back to their home network and then tromboned back to the ship. So even though the people might be a few hundred meters apart, yes, the calls might be going all the way back to Stockholm and back to the ship. And guess who pays? Yes? Yes. So the person who's calling gets to pay going one way. The surprise is, in most cases for roaming, guess who gets to pay for the other call back from Sweden? Yes, the person receiving the call. Yes, so suddenly you get this big bill saying, ah! And I got that from just answering the call. Right? You didn't realize that the calls from the other person were actually turning into international calls going all the way to Stockholm and back. Okay, so their system much more wisely says, hey, they're both here. They're both maybe even in the same cell. Why don't I just send the traffic right here on the ship? And I only have to send signaling traffic back to Stockholm, not the user's traffic. So, call delivery. The originating switching point, often called a signal transfer point, maintains a cache of the mobile identification numbers and the current VLR. And it looks in that cache, and they're, of course, one of several outcomes. No entry found. In which case, then we have to look up that mobile identification number in IFHLR, and this is called the Global Title Translation, or GTT, the full boogie lookup. A cache entry might exist and it's current, therefore we simply look in the VLR, or a cache entry exists but it's obsolete, and now we have to do a global title translation. And here, caching, of course, really pays off well, right? Because if we do this, all of this can be processed locally in the MSC using the VLR data that we have. If we have to do global title translation, what happens? All of that signaling has to go back to the HLR, and the HLR has to process all of this data. And not surprisingly, the performance for global title translation is an issue for many operators. As we said earlier, CT2 skips this whole problem because it's an originate-only system. So how can a user know and receive incoming calls? Well, we send a page to the user. The user goes to one of the points where they have CT connectivity, and we simply patch the incoming call with them calling in, and we splice the two calls together, voila, they can take their call, right? So you call this user, they're not currently connected. What do? You play them a little listening music, and while they're listening to this entertaining but boring old song, the person's been paged, they make the call, voila, you say, Joe McGuire is available now, I patch you through. So back to who makes the handoff decision. Network-controlled handoff. In this case, the base stations monitor the signal strength and quality from the mobile station. It can use multiple, and in fact, in many cases, many of the surrounding base stations to make these measurements. The mobile switching center makes the decision, and unfortunately, this is lots of networking signaling traffic, and the handoff times can be 10 seconds or more. Okay, so does that mean it's going to work if the cells are small? Yes? No. How many say yes? How many say no? Okay. Why no? Yes. Right. So the result is, because of this long handoff time, we can only deal with this in large cells. It's not going to work if the cells are small. So not surprisingly, that was used very early on in wide-area cellular systems. The next approach is mobile-assisted handoff. And here, the mobile actually collects data, digests it, and then sends the data into the system. In the case of GSM, this reduces the handoff time to about 1 second. In the case of GSM, does anyone know how often it makes this measurement? About who are the best possible base stations around me? I think it's something like every 2.5 seconds, which is still a lot of traffic, but the result is the handoff times are pretty small. Now, in both the network controlled and the mobile assisted handoff, if the network can't tell the mobile about the new channel, time slot, etc., before the link quality degrades, the call can be terminated. And there's nothing the mobile can do about it because it has no voice in this. In both cases, the network is making the decision. And now we can, of course, have mobile controlled handoff, often called automatic link transfer or time slot transfer, depending on whether we're switching between channels or switching between base stations. So here the mobile is going to make a decision, should I hand off or not? Now, why is it a great thing to have the mobile make this decision? Yes. Well, the most important thing is the mobile knows what it can hear. Right? Not only can it know what it hears, it can know even all the different systems that it can hear. Whereas in the previous two cases, the problem is that the network was doing it and was concerned about measurements in its own network. So if we're going to do handoffs between different types of networks, then we want to do mobile controlled handoffs. Now, back to this example of the so-called cluster phone. This cute little phone, which is a DECT phone combined with a GSM phone, this is one of the original prototypes. What happened? Inside the building, you started and you had a DECT call. Very nice. You weren't paying any per minute charges. As you walked out of the building, you lost connectivity with the indoor network. It automatically set up a new call using the GSM system, and you continued talking. Except what has changed? Yes, you're paying per minute charges. Okay, now, the user's outside. They walk back into the building. What happens? Okay, so he says it switches again. Any alternatives? It doesn't switch, right? And the reason is, as you walk back into the building, you still had GSM connectivity. There was no trigger that forced it to switch back to DECT. But you were in the building, yes, and you thought that you were now using DECT. Meanwhile, your battery is burning very fast, and you're racking up a bill, okay? So a hard problem about this was there was no trigger when you came back in that forced you to look around to see whether there was a better network now. Needless to say, this was not a very successful activity for the operator. Okay, so a hard problem is, what triggers me to look around to see if there's something better? Anyone guess? Right, that's looking for a better candidate. Well, one is we could just periodically wake up the DECT system and say, hey, look around and see if there's cordless connectivity. If there is, please switch. Right? But we need something to decide when to do that. If we do that too often and there isn't connectivity, then what did we just do? We just wasted a bunch of power. Right? So people have looked at adaptive schemes for deciding, should I look more frequently or not? One of the most interesting ones is if you simply put an accelerometer inside the device, what could you do? So, Carson, what could you do if you had an accelerometer in the device? Right. You could make it so that, you know, I move indoors, I shake it, and it knows. But most important, I can tell that the user is moving. Right? So if they're not moving, don't check very often. If it's sitting on the table, it doesn't need to check very often, right? But if it's moved to somewhere else, hey, it's worthwhile looking around. Question? Okay. So the process is basically, we have some measurement process that decides, is the link quality acceptable? If it is, fine, go back to measuring. Otherwise, select a new carrier and execute the handover. DECT does this in 100 to 500 milliseconds. PAC systems did in 20 to 50 milliseconds. Okay, and if 20 milliseconds is a typical voice over IP packet, this means we basically don't notice it. Unfortunately, sometimes we're going to fail. So we can have handover failures, either because there are no resources or insufficient resources, it took too long, etc. This is usually viewed as a bad thing. Then there are lots of questions about what channel do we use, etc. But in general, we're trying to avoid forced terminations. We want to somehow accommodate everybody as best we can. We don't want to have calls end. What happens when calls end unexpectedly? Anyone ever experienced calls being dropped? Right. Rarely happens in Sweden. If you're in the New York City metropolitan area, it happens all the time. Customers get upset. They're unhappy. So what do? Well, in the case of one woman in New Jersey, and I better not do it with that phone, her solution was very simple. She took the phone and threw it out the window of her car. Now, you laugh, but this was a very clever woman. She said, if I do this, other people possibly want to do this too. And so she started a research activity to figure out how to make paper phones. And as a result, she got an incredible patent portfolio for a paper phone. Yes, you put it on paper, it all folds up and becomes a phone. Very, very slick. Disposable throwaway phones. Has it reached the market? As far as I know, not yet. But customers get unhappy. And if you have an unhappy customer, what happens if you're an operator? You lose the customer, right? And since you had to pay money with advertising, et cetera, or buying, subsidizing the phone to get that customer, losing customers is a bad thing, right? So having calls, lots of calls, unexpectedly terminated is a bad thing. Now, there are all kinds of channel assignment policies, and we won't go into details about this. You can talk to Jens Zander and his students about these sorts of things if you want to know the details. But the net result is handovers are going to have to happen. We have to accommodate them, and so the issue becomes, can we hide it? We saw several different types of transfers within a cell, between cells, between base station controllers, between systems or between mobile switching centers, and even between different systems via roaming. And that's all of these different possibilities. What saves us generally is the fact that the probability of an inter-BSC handover covers about 50% of the cases. So just going from one base station to the other, that's what happens most of the time. Only a very small fraction of the time do we switch from one base station controller to another. And very rarely do we switch between mobile switching centers. So for one of the largest telecom operators for GSM in Sweden, there are only three MSCs in all of Sweden. One for the north, one for the middle, and one for the south. So the result is this case occurs very infrequently, right? But if you started your call in Kiruna and you started driving to Lund, it would still only happen twice. And that's good because we saw this was the most complex case in terms of handling an extra signaling. There are all sorts of versions of soft handoff, and one of the most interesting ones, which CDMA does, is that CDMA can have extremely precise timing at the atomic clock level. The result is that they can time the signal from the two access points so that the signal arrives at the mobile station at exactly the same time, which means the signal strength goes up because it's the additive signals from both of them. Now, this only works in San Diego, because that's the only place to have base stations, each equipped with atomic clocks to be able to show this. But it can work. And there are lots of people who are trying to understand how can you exploit this. But you can, of course, just send, if it's packet data, you can send the data from both base stations at the same time between two MSCs or between several MSCs. And so this approach to simulcasting lets you nicely have soft handovers, even though they might in fact even be different radio systems. So at this point, we'll take a break and come back in 10 minutes, and we'll talk about paging. Okay, so get started again. We mentioned earlier today paging systems, and they're invented largely, people believe, by Charles Meagher in 1949, when he was hospitalized and he got annoyed by all of the voice paging systems, because if you're ever in these hospitals, you'd hear these announcements. Will Dr. McGuire please call extension 47? And then you hear another thing, blah, blah, blah. And it just goes on day in and day out. And he said, hey, why don't we just make a transmitter that sends a stream of addresses and messages, and the pager simply listens for its address and says, hey, that's my address, grabs the message, and then displays it. The original pagers were really simple. They just had four codes called CAP codes, and it was just one of four different tones, and it was simply B. Later, they could send short voice messages, and then with digital displays in the 80s, you could even send a callback number or a code, right? So those of you who saw now Governor Schwarzenegger in this famous film where, yes, he tells the woman if he sends her the page 911, it means an emergency and she should get out, so she starts off, right? And full alphanumeric systems with full text messages appearing later. So one of my doctoral students in the 80s took advantage of this, and he made a system that would automatically page him, giving him the information about his mail messages. So it would tell him if there was someone that he was expecting mail from, or one of his close friends, it would send the header of the message in the page. Otherwise, it would just send this very carefully encrypted message saying, you know, you have 12 new messages, etc. So what's inside a pager? They're amazingly simple devices, a radio receiver and sometimes transmitter, a decoder or an encoder, some control logic, and some I/O. But what's the control logic there? Well, the most important thing is duplicate message detection, because the way that pages were delivered is by sending the page out repeatedly, hoping that one of these copies was going to get to the user. Until there was a return channel, that was the only way that you could make sure that it got to the user. You can also do message locking that says when the message arrives, don't let another message that arrives after it overwrite it. Message freezing to keep the message on the screen, and then various alerting modes. You could say, yes, send this and have it beep or vibrate or whatever, and then deal with power management. Now, the paging architecture is pretty straightforward. There's base station controller connected to a bunch of base stations, and it sends out via radio to the individual pagers. And if you want to send a page, you contact either yourself or using a terminal, send the data into the paging system, and then it deals with it. And it has a database of what customer corresponds to which particular pager. But cleverly, paging companies learn that there are some people who want to spend a little bit of money because the area over which they might move is very small. And therefore, the set of base stations that they send pages out to that customer is very limited. It might be limited to a city or a metropolitan area. There are other customers who move around much more, and they might want paging over a very large area, like the eastern seaboard of the country or the whole country. And then there are a very small set of users who might be anywhere in the world, and they want their page to go all over the world. But they'll pay a lot more money for that. And so all the base station controller really has to do is figure out, okay, which kind of customer subscription is this? Do we page locally? If so, where locally? Et cetera. It's pretty obvious. So we mentioned it can be local, regional, national, or international. One of the most common technologies used for paging is Motorola's Reflex technology. It allows two-way paging. So what happens? The user gets a page, and the user physically moves to a phone and calls the paging company and gets the message. The user moves. In the case of an alphanumeric page, the user could be told who to call. So they get in the page message, here's a phone number, and the user places the call. We could think about a mobile user now with a pager. So the mobile user directly receives the call through their mobile telephone, and there are bunches of systems that do that. But we can even support mobility which isn't wireless at all. So now here what happens is the user has a personal number, and in Sweden there were 1-700 numbers for this. And when you go somewhere, you would go to the physical phone, you would dial in an indication to the phone company telling them that your personal number was registered with this particular telephone. And so now when someone would want to contact you, the traffic would go through this now mobile telephone company, which has nothing to do with wireless, and they would simply redirect your call to where you happen to be. Right? Same basic procedures, registration and location. You could, of course, register in multiple places and have this call attempt a fixed phone, a cordless phone, or even a wide area cellular phone. And then, of course, you can have two-way paging and messaging systems. So now the user sends a text message in through a data network to the paging company, which then sends it out to your pager as a message. Now, one of the most famous ones of these services was SMS, the short message service. And SMS was incredibly successful. And similar services to SMS exist in most other wide area cellular mobile telephoning systems. But does anyone know what the problem for SMS in the GSM system was? The problem is that SMS was only put in as a packet service primarily for the operators. And therefore, it actually uses one of the control channels. Yes, you can see the problem now. And in Japan, there was a period of time where early in the evening, lots of young women would be madly sending SMS messages to each other, and no one could place any phone calls, because the control channel was completely being tied up with all of these SMSs. Okay, not surprisingly, someone got the idea, maybe it would be a good idea not to send SMSs on the control channel. And so some operators started allocating entire whole signaling and communication channels just to SMS. Now, why is that worthwhile for the operator to do? Yes, money. They make far more money delivering an SMS than they do delivering a call. Okay, so it's advantageous. You want to deliver those SMSs. And aside from the ones using up control channel bandwidth, how much does it cost the operator to send them? Almost nothing, right? That's the kind of business to be in. There's lots of issues about paging internetworking. How do you manage to couple the paging systems to other data systems so you can easily get lots and lots of messages to be sent out by paging? There are a whole variety of protocols. The latest one of these is Motorola's Generation 2 Flex system. And we see it only sends about 1,600 to 3,200 symbols per second. The fascinating thing about this is that up until this point in time, all paging traffic was unencrypted. Yes. You simply put up an antenna, and you could listen to all the paging traffic that there was. Up until roughly late 90s. So the result was all of this paging traffic was just simply there. Now, for those of you who are not Swedish, until almost the same period of time, it was a violation of the law. It was considered espionage if you simply put up an antenna and were to start receiving all of this traffic. Yeah, so you would get to enjoy the benefit of His Majesty's prison. So, or the safe prison in this case. But it was simply unencrypted. Now, almost all of the traffic is actually sent encrypted. As we said, relatively low signaling rate, supporting two-way, and even supporting voice messages. The Flex protocol is 93% of the world subscriber base of pagers. And why were they so successful in this? We began by saying this morning, the most important thing about pagers were they slept nearly all of the time. And Motorola has this very interesting patent where as the device is looking at addresses being transmitted, as soon as it finds the third bit that doesn't match, it goes to sleep. Right? Now, the reason for listening for three bits has to do with the way they do error correction, but the result is this led to a 90% increase in the amount of time they could sleep versus all their competitors, which is why they basically took over the business. All right. If we look at the timeline, we had the early analog systems in the 1970s moving up to digital systems starting in the beginning of the 90s, moving up to CDMA systems basically starting in 2000. Now, this is not because people started thinking about CDMA systems in 2000. Okay, CDMA systems had been used for a very long time by the military, but they were considered relatively expensive. So for further reading, the two books I mentioned early this morning, those of you who want more details about the physical and link layer, David Goodman has an excellent book on this, and there are piles and piles of more books. CDPD, which we'll touch on later, has a particularly interesting book because it uses mobile IP combined with this overlay technique, and the entire book is actually available online. You can go and read about all of these things. Okay, so let's take a look at network signaling. One of the things that we needed to be able to have, we said, was mobility management. We also have the problem about call control. How do we set up a call from the caller to the callee? We've got a bunch of interfaces where these systems interconnect with each other, and we have to deal with message routing. But before we can do anything, we need to have some mobile identification number to be able to identify a mobile station. In addition, we classically have a universal personal telecommunications number. That's the mobile subscriber's number. Note that there's a difference here between the device, which is a mobile station, and a user, which is a subscriber. Why is that difference important? And it was an extremely important distinguishing feature for GSM. You can change your device, right? You can take your SIM card out of one and put it in another, and voila, the other has become your device. Why? Because your subscription is tied only to the SIM card, not to the phone. It gave you enormous ability to switch phones. Contrast this with the situation in North America and Japan, where there were no SIM cards. You had a phone, and the subscription was tied to the phone. And if you wanted to have a new phone, you got a new subscription. All right? But the result is there are two identifiers. one for the device, one for the subscriber. As we mentioned, we need some protocols to be able to deal with this. One of these important protocols is the so-called Transaction Capabilities Application Part, TCAP. There are more than 50 TCAP operations in IS 140 just for inter-MSC handoff, automatic roaming, operations administration and maintenance, often considered to be one of the really boring areas of networks, but absolutely vital, as we'll see, to making the network operate. TCAP messages are basically a transaction and components. And a transaction you can think of as a query with permission, you get a response, you can have a conversation where you're going to continue to communicate, and you can have unidirectional messages where you just pass direction and one information, and they can have components, you can invoke it, you can return a result, you can return errors, and you can reject it. Now, every TCAP request has a timeout associated with it. So the result is the system is going to say, I want to query the database to find out this translation as a global title translation, where do I send the call to? Why have timeouts? Okay, why do you have timeouts in protocols ever? How long am I going to wait for an answer, right? That's the problem. Because if I don't have a timeout, I either have to wait forever, which is a bad idea, or I have to somehow figure out when I'm going to stop waiting. So by assigning timeouts for all of these, you could actually think of these in a time model and work out, is the protocol going to work all right? TCAP message flow is pretty straightforward. In this case, we see a registration request sent from the MSC, in this case to the visitor location register, by an invoke. As it's a visitor location register, it does another message to check the HLR. In this case, the user had been over here, so it goes over here, cancels their registration, sends back a confirmation, cancels the registration in the switch. Now, this VLR takes over, it goes and finds out, okay, should I give service to the user, and it goes and gets the user service profile, right? These are basically just database lookups. Now, if we think about this problem about global title translation, it's about looking up an address. So where is it going to look? How do we know who's the HLR? Right, we have to have a table of them somehow. And we'll see later when you talk about number portability of, is that a simple table, so there's a set of numbers assigned to particular operators, in which case then you can't have number portability, or how do you do it? In addition, we need global title translation because of non-geographic numbers. What are non-geographic numbers? Well, think of in Sweden, 020, right? Where's that prefix? No. Where's 020? Anyone know? It's virtual. It's anywhere in the country. It's a free phone number. The extension it actually gets delivered to is decided because of a lookup in a database. Has nothing to do with physically routing the call. Now, the problem is we're doing all of these transactions, each of which has a timeout, and one of the problems is that if we send transactions too fast, what's going to happen? Well, all of our requests are going to be failing, right? So if I just go wham, 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 sending queries in, too bad, I'm not going to get a response. So a technique called automatic code gapping is used to purposely slow down the rate at which you make requests to be no faster than the rate at which you're getting responses. And thus the system can behave much more stably. Now, not surprisingly, there's a patent for this, there's lots of work that's been done on this, but initially people didn't think about it. They just thought, okay, we have a timeout, that's okay, everything will work okay, until they started noticing, gee, the football game's over. What happened? Everybody leaves the stadium at the same time, right? So suddenly we have lots of handoff requests. Right? The plane lands at Arlanda from Germany. What happens? Everybody turns on their mobiles. Right? Usually as the plane is approaching the airport, right? So the problem is suddenly hundreds of people are registering in the cell. Okay, for those of you who study databases, this is a bad thing. Right? Because the problem is suddenly you have all of these requests. And if you have to answer all of them in a short period of time, you're going to fail on some of them. Next issue, and this is particularly an issue in the AMP systems, and that is authentication, signaling, and message encryption and voice privacy. Because not only were pages not encrypted, yet cellular voice was not encrypted either. So there are a number of former politicians who were happily chatting away on their mobile phones about the various dealings that they were going to make. You buy this piece of property over here, you give this money to my campaign, I'll put your brother on the payroll, whatever. Now, does anyone know, is it legal to listen to that traffic? Yes? It's illegal, he says. Anyone, okay, is it legal to listen to the traffic? Is it illegal to listen to the traffic? Okay, so how many for is illegal to listen? Okay, how many think it's legal to listen? Not very many. The good news is, in Sweden, it's perfectly legal to listen. Listening is absolutely permitted by anyone. Okay, what's against the law here is listening and telling. That's illegal. Okay, you laugh, but that's an issue. So we went from a world in Sweden where listening previously, for those of us who weren't Swedish citizens, was a crime in itself, to now anyone can listen. And part of the reason is that the systems now have to include encryption and privacy protection. In North America, where systems didn't include that, the politicians, after their name came out in the paper, having whatever it was they were discussing published in the newspaper, yes, rather than have a technology solution, they simply passed a law saying it's illegal to listen to cellular telephone communications. In fact, it's illegal to even have a receiver that listens to cellular telecommunications. The bad problem is, of course, the secret news. Every analog television sold in the country had a receiver in it that could listen to those frequencies. Why? Because the old frequencies, well, of the television system had been taken away and reused as the cellular frequencies. Yes, so there were loads of receivers all over the place. So what had to be done? Well, one of the methods is, before the call, to do validation of the mobile station. And the method used, not surprisingly, is a challenge. So at the time of registration, call origination, and call termination, you challenge the mobile station saying, prove to me your identity. And if you can't prove your identity, then I'm not going to let you register, have a call, or receive a call. Now, there are two problems here. It divides into a without sharing scheme and a with sharing scheme. And the reason is that there's some shared secret data that's known only to the authentication center and the mobile station in the without sharing scheme. The problem is that means that nobody else knows this. But when I'm in the visited system, what happens? Yes, it doesn't have this shared secret data, so it can't validate me. Right? So what does it have to do? Well, the visitor system has to take the challenge, send it to the mobile, get the answer back, send that with the challenge back to the home network and say, is this really the user that is your user? Because it's only the home network that could actually check, because it had a copy of the shared secret data. Had that kept expenses. The shared secret data is based on some authentic key, and it's never transmitted over the air. Although in some cases it's transmitted on the wires. So, North America, this mobile identification number, the MIN, was the phone number, because there wasn't any separation between the device and the subscription. There's also an electronic serial number that was basically a sequence number programmed in at the time the phone was manufactured, and the top 8 bits identified the manufacturer. And unfortunately, in the AMP system, both the MIN and the ESP were transmitted in the clear. So what does that mean? You go with your little radio listening device to some large airport, train station, or whatever, and you simply record all of the MINs and ESPs that you hear. Then what you do, you go home, program a bunch of handsets with those MINs and ESPs, and guess what happens? You just clone the phones. Yes, but the clone phone, it has the information now it needs to be able to make and receive calls just the same as the other phone. Right? So cloning phones was an incredibly big black market business. It led to hundreds of millions of dollars of fraud, and therefore a new standard was introduced, TSB 51, which said, okay, we're going to have to encrypt all of that data. So what's going to happen? Well, the base stations periodically send out location information, and when a mobile hears that it's moved to a new location area, it sends back a registration request. The mobile switching center sends in response a random number. The mobile station takes that random number, uses its secret, and computes a response to the challenge and increments the counter saying, this is how many times I've been challenged, here's my identity, sends it back. The authorization request gets propagated all the way back to the home location. Register who then sends it to this authentication database who verifies both the authentication response and the count. And so if it sees the counts don't match, it says, oops, somebody else has been answering. If everything matches, it sends back a result saying, okay, yes, provide the user with the service. So without sharing to originate a call, we have to send all of this data clear back to the home network to be able to decide, is the user allowed to make this call? And in addition, we send back a voice privacy mask and a signaling key mask back to this network so that we can now secure both the voice call and the signaling. Right, so everything has to propagate clear to the home network, which is expensive. With sharing, we send the authentication request in, we authenticate the user, and now, when a request comes along, we only check to see, aha, is everything happy? Now we don't have to go clear back to the home network to authenticate the user when they actually want to make a call. When should you use one or the other? Well, obviously, it depends on how often the user moves. They don't move very often. There's no reason to do all the sharing. That's just more data to keep in your database that you don't need, particularly for users who are not there. So what was this TS51 we talked about earlier, later replaced by TS45B? It's a set of algorithms for cellular authentication and voice encryption. It's how to compute those authentication results using the shared secret and the two identifiers and the random value. And the random value was typically updated every 20 minutes, and the SSD is updated for each mobile subscriber every 7 to 10 days. So even if you did manage to physically get hold of a phone, you wouldn't be able to continue to operate as a clone beyond this time because the shared secret data would now be invalid. The bad news is 3 out of the 4 algorithms and part of this were all broken. These were all done in secret. The operators never told people other than the other vendors how all of this was done, but yet it was all broken. And this was a very important lesson. Why? Well, guess what happened in GSM? When GSM was done, the similar problems, of course, they said, we have to handle them right from the start. We're going to put in these forms of encryption for authentication, for call signaling, for privacy, and yes, it's all secret. Guess what happened to the GSM algorithms? Yes, they too were all broken. So anyone know what's been done now in the third generation 3GPP type network? The algorithms aren't secret anymore. They published all of the algorithms. They said, here's a standard set of algorithms, and they purposely tried to get people to break them, giving them all the information about how the algorithm works. And the thought is, if with all of that you still can't break it, then probably it's going to remain secure. The problem is these systems only gave the illusion of security. Okay. Now, all of you know GSM includes encrypted voice communication, right? Is there anyone who doesn't know that? Okay, is there anyone from Australia here? Yes, Australia is very interesting. It turns out, yes, every GSM handset must be able to support encrypted voice communication. That doesn't mean it does. And in Australia, every operator has it turned off. Yes, so all of the voice communication is sent in the clear. Now, has anyone looked at their GSM phone and said, how do I know whether it's encrypting the voice traffic or not? Can you know that? No. There's no GSM phone that'll tell you whether it's actually using encryption or not. So here we have something where you think it's being encrypted because it could be, and it may or may not be. So 3G systems today are actually supposed to be able to let you know whether the encryption is operating or not. However, I haven't yet seen a 3G handset that easily tells me whether it's operating in encrypted mode or not. But it may be an issue. Okay. We can do the similar type of things in the PAC system, this personal access and communication system, providing basic call control, roaming, handoff, and all of that, without using an MSC or an HLR, but instead using the Advanced Intelligent Network Scheme, which is what's implemented, for instance, in ISDN. And so we can build all the same kind of functionality, but on top of a completely different kind of network. Okay, so here's a system that basically is using cordless technology, but yet now it has a mobility database, it has a switching center, it has a gateway, all the things you've seen before. The access manager that acts basically now like the VSC, the switching center, and it even performs the automatic code gapping, accounting, and all of those sorts of things. It has a logical equivalent to the home location register and the visitor location register, and even the authentication center. And amazingly enough, it still uses TCAP. And it supports handoffs. But because the cells are much smaller, one of the clever things that's done is doing lots of the handoff within the switch, the inter-ARP PCU. Okay, so now we're going to shift gears a little bit. We're going to talk about CDPV, which I've mentioned several times before. It was developed in 1992 by AT&T. It's a cellular digital packet data protocol, hence its initials. It's data only. and it reuses the analog system. The data rate was rather small, only about 1.5 kilobytes per second. And the clever thing was it basically listens for vacant channels. So CDPB has no physical connection to the underlying analog cellular network. They simply put up another antenna on the same towers and connected them into this new CDPB infrastructure. The result is the CDPB mobile base stations do channel sniffing. They simply listen to all of the normal analog channels and say, ah, here's an analog channel that's free right now, let me use that. It basically implements the predecessor of mobile IP, mobile asterisk IP, that my student John Ioannidis do. And as I said, there's this really excellent book about CDPB. And the motivation for CDPB was basically there are a whole bunch of analog systems, and they weren't very suitable for data. Long setup times, lots of modem handshaking, and problems. However, the providers already had frequencies. So they had the basic radio resources. So the idea was just simply reuse them. That means you didn't need a new license. As long as you didn't interfere with your own traffic, after all, it was your assigned frequency, you were all happy. So low-speed data, paging, short messages, email, broadcast and multicast, for instance, fleet management, always online, packet services, and it was completely transparent to the AMP service, but shared the spectrum with it. Very clever, as I said. It basically took the AMP base stations and simply put a new CDPB base station. They were interconnected by a set of routers. Voila, off you go. So there's a mobile end system, radios at 9.2 kilobits per second, a mobile base station, and a mobile data intermediate system, basically a frame relay plus packet router. And then, of course, an accounting server, authentication servers, directory servers, and network management. Now, one of the fascinating things was, as we said, it was a completely separate system. The radius of the cells was limited to about 17 kilometers. There was no mobile-to-mobile communication. You had to go into one of these intermediate routers and back out. And you were only allowed to send two packets back-to-back. So until you got an acknowledgement, you couldn't send any more packets. Why was that done? So you couldn't monopolize the resources. Other people would have to get a chance to transmit. And because you would get more capacity as you got responses, the system would automatically adapt. It supported handoffs. It kept a list of temporary equipment identifiers. This was a very clever thing most people think was invented with GSM. It was already in CDPB. And the idea of a temporary equipment identifier is that rather than sending out your real identifier all of the time, which would be easy to sniff, when you register, you got issued a new temporary identifier, and now for all your communications, you use the temporary identifier. Now, why is it a bad idea to transmit a fixed identity all of the time? Okay. Do any of you have wireless LAN in your laptop? Okay. Now, what happens if I sit here with a device and sniff the wireless LAN? What will I learn? I'll learn all of your MAC addresses. Right? And since I have a list of all of your names here, yes, I can now track you around because of that MAC address, which your wireless LAN card sends in every packet that you emit. And so KTH got in quite a lot of trouble a number of years ago when an article appeared in nearly every afternoon paper one Friday of KTH Big Brother. And unfortunately, Alberto Escudero Pascual named his system Big Brother, and yes, he mined the information that was available in every base station about Yes, the list of MAC addresses in every cell. So you could tell who was near each other, or you could infer who was near each other because their MAC addresses would keep showing up in the same cells. You could know what classes they were in by comparing the class schedule with the list of MAC addresses, who attended class, who didn't attend class, etc. It became a very, very big problem. By Monday morning, the president of KTH had been in communications with the dean all the way back down the chain, and the graduate student was thinking about his future activity somewhere else because it was viewed as a major violation of privacy. So you don't want to use fixed identifiers, even though wireless LAN do. However, it gave him a topic for a thesis later. The mobile basically listens for broadcasts that supported connectionless data services, both ISO and IP. As we said, it supported roaming management, and it basically supported mobile IP. It also supported multicast, which is rather interesting. So you could have a group identifier, and the result is you could subscribe and receive packets to this group ID the same way you could receive them to your fixed ID. Now, interestingly enough, CDPUD was incredibly popular for vending machines. Why for vending machines? Okay, anyone here ever fill vending machines? Okay, the problem is, right, you get out of your truck, you go in, you take this massive key, open up the door, and now you see, aha, I need, 15 more cans of this, 12 of that, 2 of that, etc. You close the door, lock it all back up, go out to your truck, load up your hand cart, wheel it in, unlock the thing, stock it up, off you go. Right? So you had to make two trips. Worse is, if you didn't get there in time, the vending machine was empty, and customers were unhappy because there was nothing for them to buy. Right? And if you went too often, you went there and mostly it was full and there was no work to do, and you weren't making much money. So the result is, what do? You put a CDPD system in your vending machine, and it updates you automatically when things are being sold. So now when you arrive at your truck, you know exactly what to bring in to fill the machine up. You laugh, but there's enormous amounts of money at stake here for a relatively small number of bits. Right? The vending machine didn't have to be very chatty. It just had to, once a day or something like that, send out data. Now, why might a vending machine want to receive data? Well, in Japan, someone realized that there's no reason that vending machines needed to have fixed prices for the items in the vending machine. Right? So if the weather prediction is it's going to be hot, warm, and muggy, yes, the price of cold sodas increases. Right? Very clever. Another big use was for public safety, particularly law enforcement. And so police cars started getting equipped with CDPD terminals so that the officer could type in the license number, automatically check, is this vehicle reported to be stolen, etc., get a response back. Now, why didn't they use their normal police radios? They didn't support data at all. And even worse is, they were unencrypted. So there were big privacy problems about, yes, license number 46572 Echo Charlie, right? And anyone listening could hear that. And handhelds and laptops. Pricing was relatively modest for very small amounts of data, and of course, you could buy unlimited plans too. The bad news is that in 2002, of course, CDPD had to be eliminated. Why? There were no analog telephony networks anywhere whose frequencies CDPD could use. So with 85% of the U.S. subscribers switching to digital phones, AMP systems were simply being shut down. And so now lots of vendors face the problem of, how do we get users to move from their CDPD, which was working well enough for them, to some new systems And yes, it takes a while to do that. But there was no choice. Now another company came along and said, hey, this idea of packet data, that's pretty slick. So they introduced a network called Ricochet. And Ricochet, which now of course operates under at least two different changes in names, had a very simple idea saying, these data base stations were a good idea, but the hard problem is to put the data base stations out, we need a backhaul back to our routed network. Right? We saw that the base stations were connected into this packet network. The problem is, the only way we can connect our base stations into the network is we have to go to the telephone company and rent a circuit, and guess what? We're trying to compete with the telephone company by offering packet data. So guess what happens to all of our requests to get our base stations connected? Yes, they get filed away or slowly processed. So they introduced a rather neat idea, and that is they rented space on the top of lampposts, you know, the lampposts out on the street. They rented the tops of them. Why? Well, the price was good, and there was electrical power. So they put in their base stations on the top of each of these lampposts, and then they used multi-hop radio techniques so that you would go from your terminal to the nearest lamppost. It would then proceed to forward it block by block, lamppost by lamppost, until it finally reached one of their base stations that was actually wired into the packet data network. And then it would get routed where it was going. And the huge advantage of this is you could quickly cover a whole city, and where there were lots of users, then you would add more base stations that were connected to the fixed network. But where there were few users, there were plenty of resources to go hop, hop, hop. Very, very slick system. Meantime, for round trip time, 2,450 milliseconds. Right? 2.5 seconds to send a packet and get a response. However, it worked. Supporting 50 to 58 kilobits per second data rates. When at the time, your alternative would have been to pay a lot of money to the cellular operator, this was a pretty good deal. And then it was later upgraded to, by 2000, supporting 128 kilobits per second. The architecture was really simple. These little Ethernet radios, they attach to this fixed network, mobility gateways to connect to the internet, and then these pole top transmitters, and then we would simply go from this one to this one to this one to this one, voila, zoop, off we go. And it worked. Not surprisingly, we have pole top modems, pole top radios, or portable modems, pole top radios, these base stations, gateways, name servers, etc., all the normal things you would expect, including, accounting databases, etc. And you can read more about this if you want. So, any questions? Yes?
I'd like to ask about the clone phone system.
Yes?
So you have a clone phone in either the GSM or the AMP system?
No, not in the GSM system.
In
the AMP system, yes.
Does it happen in the GSM?
No.
It can happen in
HP? No, you don't clone the phone. You clone the SIM card. Yes.
But okay, but if I make a phone call to this or the clone,
yes.
Who's going to receive the call? The clone phone or the normal phone?
No, in fact, from the network's point of view, they're both the same phone.
Yes.
Right?
So
they will both get paged, and if they both respond in many networks, they will both ring, and whichever one answers first, that's where the call will get set up. Okay. In Greece, we should point out, there was a much bigger issue, and that is the copying of the data in the phone network, where actually the call was duplicated and delivered to both the intended receiver and to somewhere else. And that's different from cloning. That was actually because the mobile switching center made a copy of all of the call contents and sent them somewhere else. And that happened in the GSM system, and I think led to the single largest fine ever in Greece for a violation, something in the neighborhood of more than 300 million krona to the operator, and something like 10% of that to Ericsson, who built the equipment. And the reason that the cloning of the data happened is because law enforcement requires that there be a way to basically tap calls. And we'll talk about that actually tomorrow whenever we talk about law enforcement access. Any other questions? Okay, so let's go directly on here to GSM. The GSM system, as we said, the global system for mobile communication, was designed to be a digital wide area system driven by the European telecom companies, building on the success actually of the Nordic mobile telephony system. And not surprisingly enough, Sweden and the Nordic operators were a very major player in the design of GSM. And I was told by Ossi Makkantalo, who's a guest professor here at KTH, who was head of Telia, then Televerkkos efforts for GSM, that every time there was a big meeting to set more standards about GSM, the Swedish contingent would throw a big party announcing the number of subscribers they had. And they kept embarrassing all of the other German, French, et cetera, people at this because of the large number of cellular customers that they had, because cellular telephony had very big uptake in the Nordic countries, much more so than many other places. But it gave them a strong voice in helping set the new standards. Now, the requirements were service portability. The mobile should be used in any of the participating countries. International roaming had to work, standardized dialing, numbering, et cetera, but of course with potentially different rates, usable for wireline services and for mobile service, and as we said, even up to high speed. Quality of service and security were built in and were supposed to be as good as the analog systems. It had very good radio frequency utilization. It supported a modern network with all the sorts of standardized interfaces, et cetera. And the system was optimized to limit the cost of the mobiles. So the idea is the mobiles should be inexpensive at the cost even of making the base stations more expensive. And however, it required much more complex handsets. The GSM architecture looks like this. And this is where you sort of first go, say, oh my, whatever. So here's the what we were calling the mobile station, which now is still a mobile station, but it has two pieces, the mobile equipment and the SIM card. A radio link following the U sub M standard to a base station, the BTS, which had an ADIS interface to the base station controller, which had an A interface to the MSC, which could have an E interface to other MSCs, one of which was the gateway MSC. It had a B interface to the visitor location register. The visitor location registers could be connected by a G interface. The HLR and the VLR had a D interface, and the HLR and the AUC had an H interface, and the MSC could talk to the HLR over the C interface, and it could talk to something called the equipment register, which contained information about stolen handsets, et cetera, by an F interface. Yes, horrible, horrible, horrible. Each one of these things had a whole volume that described the interface. Now, why define all of these different interfaces? Yes. Okay, he suggests security, not the reason. Standardization. The idea was you ought to be able to go to any vendor who sold a VLR, and as long as they provided this interface and that interface, boom, it would work. Great idea, right? It should increase competition, et cetera, et cetera. Now, have any of you read the GSM standards? Okay, shelf meters. something like the initial standard was more than 1,700 pages, right? Because all of these things had to be standardized. All the functions had to be standardized. Now, if you promise not to quote me outside of the room, part of the whole reason of this was to make it very expensive for anyone to implement this equipment. Right? You needed thousands of employees to go and build your VLR, your HLRs, all of these different things, because it took hundreds of employees just to read the documentation. Right? So this basically eliminated a lot of potential competitors. As I said, please don't quote me outside of this room on that. It was a time division, slow frequency hopping system. Here are all the details. Very straightforward. GSM made three important contributions. It has location-based mobility management, it incorporated mobile-assisted handoffs, and it introduced, they think, temporary mobile subscriber IDs, TMSIs. Of course, yes, they were actually originated in CBPD. Distinctive features, it's available and was developed by lots of people in lots of countries. Open interfaces, unfortunately, a very large number of interfaces, and it was a phase system. So in the first phase, targeted for introduction in 1991, it supported telephony at full rate. It was a mere 5,320 pages at that point, emergency calls, and low data rate data transmission. In phase two, you could have non-voice services, high-speed circuit switched, and then in phase two plus, it introduced multiple service profiles, private numbering plans, interworking with various GSM systems and even DECT, and then in phase two and a half, the global packet radio system, which introduced packet data services for the first time to GSM, and then later EDGE, the enhanced data rate for GSM. So this phased introduction was a very important part of GSM. So you could get started, you could have a digital replacement for an analog network, and then slowly add these other pieces. But at a minimum, you had to have a mobile station, and it had to have the subscriber identity module. And this was one of the keys for portability. So what the operators issued and controlled were SIM cards. And you could go and buy any GSM phone and put your SIM card in it, and now you had your mobile terminal. Okay? Why is that so important? It meant customers could choose their own telephone. Okay? In North America, to this point in time, almost all telephones have to be selected by, yes, the operator. The customer has no choice. So for instance, if you go to Verizon and you say, I want to buy a cellular telephone, they say, yes, any of these phones that we have. And you say, but I'd like to buy a Nokia phone. No what? They don't sell Nokia phones at all. They used to sell lots of Nokia phones, in fact, enormous numbers of Nokia phones. Anyone know why they don't sell them anymore? Because Nokia upset them, because Nokia introduced a set of cell phones that supported both wide area cellular and wireless LAN. And, oh yes, they put in voice over IP support into the handset. And Verizon's management said, that's it, no more Nokia phones. We're banning them all. Okay? And the customer didn't have a choice because there's no SIM card in most cases that would let you easily move your subscription from one phone to another until, of course, the introduction of large numbers of GSM handsets from elsewhere. The SIM card, it's very small form factor. It's basically a chunk out of a credit card with a smart card. The user can have a PIN for it. If the PIN's incorrectly entered, it can lock. So you use a PIN and locking code. You can update it remotely under something called the SIM toolkit, which is very neat. You can actually program these things remotely. And the SIM is owned by the operator. An interesting feature is that SIMs were required to hold at least two profiles, and it includes an international mobile subscriber identity because you were going to have a subscriber identity no matter where in any GSM network you were. This fact that you could hold two profiles, I point out, means that you could think about, when I arrive in Greece for my vacation, what do I do? Well, my operator, Telia for instance, downloads to me a local new profile which gives me a number that's a local number in Greece. So now I can take advantage of the low price calls using my local number, but still be reachable by my Swedish number, and everything works very well. As far as I know, there are no major operators taking advantage of this and doing this to this day. Why? Because they would really like you not to know that you could do that, and so that you'd have to pay, yes, your home operator for all of your calls, or force you to switch. And here's an example of one side of the card. We can see little gold contacts. There's the other side of it, and there's the IMSI number printed on it. And here's the little SIM card reader that is in the back of the phone and with the card stuck in. Now, okay, Carsten, what's the problem with having the SIM card reader in the phone? Is this a good idea from a packaging point of view or not? I pick on him since he's doing the Mark's course. Is it a good idea? Yes. So when initially GSM phones came out, this was not a bad idea, right? Because GSM phones cost 300 or 400 euros. Okay. What happens when this phone costs the manufacturer 30 euros? Is this a good idea or not? A good idea? Not. It turns out it becomes a bad idea because the cost of this reader now starts to be a major part of the cost of the phone. Right? Because after all, what's on this thing? It's just a tiny little, typically 4 8-bit microcontroller and a little bit of non-volatile memory. Right? We could put that in the phone, which has a multiple hundreds of millions of instruction per second signal processing chip in here, and probably has a many hundreds of million of instruction per second processor. And oh yes, it has a gigabyte of memory and, you know, a quarter of a gigabyte of flash. So today one of the problems is these things may start going away, except for the fact that they're required to have it be a GSM phone. So I think it's an interesting area, and we're going to see some changes there. The phone itself, the mobile equipment, needed, of course, to have a radio, and the radio is operated in all sorts of different frequency ranges, depending on whether you were in Sweden, later Sweden, or the UK. And the mobile equipment is identified by an international mobile equipment identity, an INEI. So if we actually look here, we can see printed along here the IMEI number. So when your phone is being used in an operator's network, which do they use? The IMEI or the IMSI? Anyone want to guess? Okay. IMEI, anyone? Okay, that sounds like a good idea. Unfortunately, it actually turns out it's optional. It's actually an option whether you ever check the IMEI number at all. And the standards say this is an option. And the EIR database, which can contain a list of IMEIs, that's also optional. Okay? But if you implement it, it means that if you report your phone stolen, it won't be able to be used in any network that actually checks the IMEI. A question?
Yeah.
Yes. But it's optional whether you do that. That's why most stolen phones all migrate in a certain direction, right, to the networks that don't check IMEI. Okay. Now, to reduce power saving, the system can do a whole bunch of things, like discontinuous transmission, discontinuous reception, etc. It has loads and loads of clever things to deal with power control. In addition, phones can support different capabilities, like different amounts of maximum power. Yes, a 20-watt transmitter, of course, only for vehicles. Very low power units. Whether it supports encryption or not, which bands it can operate in, and whether it's SMS capable. And all of this gets encoded in a 32-bit classmark. So the phone not only has this IMEI, the subscriber has an IMFI, and then there's the temporary mobile subscriber identity of a TMFI. These two things are only 15 bits, that's 32 bits. The IMEI includes the type approval, information about where it was built, so there's a set of bits, there's a set of bits, and a check digit, and a six-digit sequence number. There's even an international mobile vendor identification and software version number, so you can even tell which version of the firmware the handset is running. And here's the construction of an IMSI. And it's the high order set of bits here, the mobile country code, that identify which particular country has issued this. Then we have the mobile network code, and then we have the mobile station identifier code. Now, the interesting thing is there are actually a set of mobile country codes which are not countries. How can we have a country code? It's because there are actually some entities that exist all around the world, particularly on the ocean. So there are a set of numbers that are allocated for various mobile subscribers who are not in any particular country. And we'll see later how that gets used. And we said the TMSI got assigned to visiting nodes. In addition, the mobile terminal supports AT commands, and there are all kinds of different interesting messages that you can send via this extended AT command. That was the mobile. Now, what about the base station? Well, there was a base station subsystem consisting of one or more base station transceivers plus one or more base station controllers. The base station transceiver system itself, of course, had the radio, and it does the encoding and decoding plus the encryption or decryption if it's going to be done. That means my encrypted call, if I have it, is encrypted all the way, yes, only to the base transceiver station. After that, it's in plain text. Right? So anyone who can get connected to that backhaul can listen to all the conversations. Yes, they're all in plain text. Now, if you look around in Stockholm and you see lots of cellular towers on top of buildings, you'll note that some of them also have a microwave link on the same tower. Right? Anyone know what the microwave link is for?
That could be a directional link towards the next station.
Yes, but it's the backhaul from that base transceiver station to the operator's base station controllers. Yes, since the BCS decrypts the call, guess what happens on the microwave link as it's going back to the BSC? Yes, it's unencrypted. Not that I'm suggesting that you should listen to this traffic. All right. Almost half the processing in a BCS is encoding and transcoding of the pulse code modulated voice. And the reason is the GSM uses one voice coding, and that ABIS interface that was defined, yes, was a traditional 64 kilobit per second telephony voice channel. So we have to go from 14.4 kilobits per second to 64. Somebody has to do that processing. It's done in the BTS. Now, why is that an issue? Well, it turns out if you didn't have to do this speech transcoding, it's trivial to make BCSs out of PCs. But having to do this large amount of computation means you need high-end PCs to do it, because you need to do a lot of signal processing. The base station controller itself manages all the calls. It measures the signal strength, as we said, about a little more than twice a second every 480 milliseconds. It does all of the handover management. It manages power control. And if we look at the set of tasks it's doing, about 20 to 25% is associated with calls, about 10 to 15% with paging and SMS, 20 to 25% is mobility management, and interestingly enough, 15 to 20% is just hardware checking and network trigger events. So collecting data and managing the system is taking a fair amount of capacity. About 80% utilization is what the system is designed for. And if the load goes over that, then you start to shed load by rejecting location updates. That's mobiles announcing, hey, I moved into your area, but I'm not making a call yet. Rejecting mobile station originated calls, and if things are still worse, you start ignoring handoffs. Now, why should any of these things occur? Because you only designed the system to handle 80% utilization. And these things can vary a lot, and so what happens if everybody is varying in the same direction, like lots of handoffs happen and lots of people start making calls, you don't have enough capacity. Paging and SMS, you send lots and lots of SMSs, you can cause the system to start to not to be able to make calls and start to not do handoffs. And so there's a very nice paper by a researcher at Penn State University 2 years ago who showed that a group of people acting as a smart mob by making paging SMS calls could bring the entire mobile network of one of the New York Manhattan cellular operators to a halt. And yes, he gave complete plans for how to do this if he wanted to be a terrorist mob. And the reason is that it turns out that this is the averages. The problem is if you have a whole bunch of people who all make a call setup request at the same time, these peaks can be very high. And the system was never dimensioned to handle very large peaks. It assumes that people will make choices to make calls at different times, and so they'll be spread out. So it never had the resources for coordinated traffic. There's also a network switching, network and switching subsystem that consists of the MSCs, in particular the gateways to other networks, the various databases, and other gateways. The databases we've talked a lot about, the home location registry, the visitor location registry, the authentication center, and then this equipment identity registry. Sometimes, instead of blacklisting bad or stolen handsets, it contains a whitelist. So only these handsets may be allowed to make calls. And in some cases, there are phones that are graylisted. And graylisted phones, this is usually associated more often if there's a suspicion about a particular handset. We're not sure that it's a bad guy yet, but we think it may be. And sometimes this is actually used by law enforcement, because if a phone appears in these registries and you're running one of this, you get an alert notification that this phone is attempting to use the network. And you can use that as a trigger to do various other things. As we said, it's completely optional. If you use it, you can basically bar calls from a particular mobile station, not from a subscriber. There's no database that says this is a deadbeat subscriber. You simply remove this subscriber from your database. Now, an interesting thing is that even without a SIM card, it's required that a GSM phone be able to make emergency calls. Okay? So even if there's no SIM at all, you can dial 112 and you'll get your emergency call. So who pays? Anyone know? We all pay. That's included in part of the overhead that the operator charges us for. There's also, as we mentioned, this operating subsystem. It's the operation and maintenance center, and it does all sorts of various service management. Things like the subscription management, putting new subscribers in the system, modifying and removing subscriptions, as well as billing, and most importantly, in addition to billing, fraud detection, detecting patterns that are suspicious. And then the operation maintenance center does network management and does various sorts of things about dealing with the equipment. This is often vital to planning the systems. So as we said, there are all these different interfaces, and you can read about all the letters of them, study them, put it up. But not only do we have all these different interfaces, but if we now take the sideways view of the protocol stack, we see lots and lots of different protocols. So at this physical layer, we have a radio communication protocol between the mobile station and the BTS. We have a link layer protocol using LAPD. And then we have a radio resource management protocol that's divided between the base transceiver system and the BSC. Then we have a mobility management system that is yet another protocol between the MSC and the MS. And then we have a set of things for call management sitting on top of this. So we have a fairly complex protocol stack. And then we have all of these things over here for supporting TCAP and the mobility management. So not surprisingly, we, of course, in the GSM standard have a physical layer spec, a data link spec, and a network layer specification. You can read all about these low levels at your own leisure. So as I mentioned earlier, a hard problem is this fact that the ABIS interface was designed to be a traditional telecom interface. In 1994, roughly, there's a visit from a group of researchers at Berkeley, and I introduced them to people at Ericsson, and the result is they did a project called Iceberg, and they said we could replace this ABIS interface by simply using IP interfaces. Thus, we could plug the BTS in anywhere that we had an IP network connectivity, and thus potentially decrease the cost. Interestingly enough, this has become important today because of the problem is the signaling channels that are available on the standard ABIS interface, which is just an E1 interface, for those of you looking at normal telephony systems, don't provide enough bandwidth for all the signaling that modern BTSs want to support. And so there's a moving pressure to say, hey, get rid of this interface, and it'll probably happen. It has its whole stack, protocol stack. Then we have the A interface between the BSC and MSC. It also faces the problem of not having enough signaling capacity. It has its whole set of protocols. Just a few words about GSM audio. As we said, the goal was to take the voice, encode it, and compress it so that we could fit it in this narrow voice channel. And at the time that GSM was done, 20 milliseconds of voice representing 160 samples at 8 kilosamples per second and 13 bits per second were buffered, then coded, and then error protection added and transmitted. Later, of course, codecs got better, and they didn't need all of these bits, so we had an introduction of so-called half rate. So instead of 13 kilobits per second, only 5.6. And today, what we see is adaptive multi-rate codes, which basically adapt themselves based upon voice content, et cetera. And we even have wideband adaptive multi-rate codecs today that can send high-quality audio. And you can read more about this. Then we have the MSC has all of these different interfaces. We talked about some of them, and they have various protocols that are used with them. The GSM radio channel, this U sub M channel, is divided into a number of traffic channels, both full rate and half rate, and then lots of signaling channels. Some are broadcast, some are common control channels, like for paging, some are dedicated control channels. The traffic for a traffic channel has 24 time slots for traffic, one for flow associated control, and interestingly enough, one of them that isn't used at all. You can read about the broadcast channels, the common control channels, so some are downlink, some are uplink, and then the dedicated control channels. A bit is this amount of time. They're put into slots, put into frames, grouped into multi-frames, super frames, and then hyper frames, 3 hours and 28 minutes. So it's all very complex timing. This whole thing relies on amazing coordination of timing, all the way down to a quarter of a bit at 900 nanoseconds. So one of the interesting results of this is that because radio waves only propagate at roughly the speed of light, the time it takes to get from where I am to the base station becomes an issue for the communication between me and the base station. Why? Well, remember, we said that we were dividing this channel up into these 24 different slots, right? So I have to make sure that when my packets arrive, they arrive in the time frame that's given for me, and when your packets arrive, they arrive in your time frame, even though we might be at different distances from the base station. Okay? The result is that there's something in GSM called timing advance, and that is the base station tells me you need to start transmitting at this much before your time slot so that it arrives at the base station at the right time. Okay, so if we have a timing advance value associated with each of the mobile subscribers, what can we do? We can locate where the subscribers are to within roughly 100 meters, because that represents the different values of the time advance. Okay? So not only can we know which base stations the user can hear, because they're giving us that information back because of the mobile assisted handoffs, but we can actually know how far from the base station they are based on this timing advance information. And therefore, we can actually calculate in an angular part of the cylinder where the user has to be. And of course, if the user is moving, we can now estimate where the user is rather well. So what happens in an incoming call? Well, it goes into the gateway MSC, it looks in the HLR, figures out which of the VLRs to go to, looks in the VLR. Now the VLR tells the mobile switching center, hey, the user might be in this region, so it sends out pages to the user. The user answers back. We update the VLR, and now we send back the information to the gateway MSC, and now we can deliver the call to where the user is. All of that just to deliver a call. Now, what happens if the user doesn't answer the call? Right? The phone rings, and they don't answer. Yes, the operator just paid for all the costs of doing that, using all these resources, and they made nothing. Right?
Some operators can transfer the call if the phone is ringing, like after 6 tries, the operator can charge.
Okay, so one is we could charge the users for these undelivered calls. What do most operators like to do instead? Right. But what's the real big money maker that's done? If the user doesn't answer, what happens? Do you send back, no, the user didn't answer to the caller? No. You take the call and you send it off to a voicemail system. Right? So now you make money for terminating the call, and you send the user an SMS saying you missed the call. What does the user do? They get their SMS, and yes, they place a call to go and listen to their message on the voicemail system. Yes, and you got to charge them for the call they made and for the SMS that you sent them, right? Operators love this.
But most people, what they do, they
That's one method, which is to say, use the caller line identification information so that I know who it is who tried to call me, and now I can just call them back. But that came later. But voicemail was a very, very big money maker simply because it meant that you made lots of money with the SMS and the people calling in to listen to their voicemail. Mobility management, as we said, mobile systems need to think about this. GSM does it by keeping track of which mobile phones are powered off. And so the phone is constantly sending updated information. When the phone moves into a different service area called a location area, the phone notices that, and now it registers. So you can actually go and see there's a set of location area identifiers, and every BCS has its own notification, and thus the result is we have a cell ID. So there's a student here at Stockholm University here in Kista that built a very neat little service so they would automatically configure his phone differently when he was here in Kista and when he was at home. And how did he know whether he was at home or in Kista? That's right. He just listened to the cell ID. An amazingly useful thing, and it's being broadcast out happily by the BTSs. Now, in some countries, such as Germany, there's actually a database of all these cell IDs with their GPS coordinates, so you can actually get rather good information about where you physically are in the country by simply listening to which cell IDs you can hear. Yes, there's some people building these up. Security, as we said, we had the PMSI. GSM introduces several important features to be able to support authentication and encryption, an algorithm for authentication, an algorithm for enciphering, an algorithm for enciphering key computation, so how do you compute it, a secret encryption key, and a cipher key. And there's a fairly complex method. But you always have to start in non-ciphered mode, of course, because ciphering requires a key, and we need to somehow learn what the key is. But once we have done that exchange, then we can go on, and off we go. And if one looks at authentication, basically what happens is a random number, as we said, gets sent, and in this case, it gets sent to the mobile station, fed through the A8 algorithm to go to encryption, through the A3 algorithm to calculate a remainder. That's compared with the computation that happens in the home system. If these match, then the device has authenticated itself. If we've authenticated it, then we use the same random number through the A8 algorithm plus our secret key to compute a cipher key, and now we use the A5 algorithm to encrypt the traffic that we're actually sending. And as we mentioned, there are a bunch of different load state data rates, but they have rather high delays. Now, why should these delays be so high? It's because of bit interleaving. It's actually the actual channel rate is always 9.6. This is just sent by sending 2 bits, 4 bits, and in the half rate cases here with non-transparency, we have retransmissions. The result is it just is added overhead. Systems engineering, a lot of money gets spent by operators to figure out how many of each of these elements we need and where do we put them. And the goal is basically to put base stations where we have lots of customers. Why? Anyone know how much a base station costs? Going rate some time ago were about a million Swedish krona per base station. Anyone know how many base stations there are in the world for GSM? Order of magnitude, about 250,000, half a million of them. Not huge numbers. Why would you care how many base stations there are? Anyone know? But the problem is, if there are not a lot of base stations, it's not worth building special integrated circuits for them because you don't have enough volume. And the numbers I just gave are for all of the different vendors. So the result is there wasn't a big effort heavily integrating them. Today what's happening is people are moving towards so-called pico cells, very small cells, or in some cases even femto cells, having a home base station. The volumes are going up tremendously, and therefore the cost per one goes down. Lots of efforts go into the GSM network optimization so that 15% of the traffic we saw being used for system was doing things like traffic analysis, monitoring how much traffic there was, looking at bit error tests, sending alarms whenever you pass certain thresholds, doing quality testing. So amazingly enough, the network in the background is doing lots of testing, taking advantages of the fact that there are millions of users out there with handsets moving all around through the area. So it gives us the perfect way of measuring what the radio propagation characteristics are in the area, right? Because you basically have mobile probes moving all around. There's lots of work in cell planning. Classically, the estimate was 1 man-year of effort per cell. Right? Because if you're going to spend ₹1 million, you could afford to spend almost 1 man-year of time to plan the cell optimally, both physically where it was, what angle you tilted the antennas, various site parameters, power levels, network parameters, etc. There were big amounts of money spent in optimizing cells. What happens whenever base stations are 1/10 or 1/100 the price? Yes? You can't do 1 year of optimization if the base station costs what the engineer has to be paid for a month. Right? It's not worthwhile. So what do? Just throw more base stations at it. Right? Put more base stations around. So what's the problem about putting in lots of base stations? What? Interference, okay. What else? The what? Okay, so we have a problem about frequency assignments. What else? Yes? Right, so we have an increased problem if the cell sizes are smaller, doing more handoffs. What else? Yes, we mentioned interference. Yes, well, what part of cost is the problem? Okay, maintenance, someone says. What else? Yeah, buying new equipment. That was noise. Yes. License, not a problem. Yes. Power. Electrical power. Anyone know how much electrical power it takes? Well, the bad news is that in big base stations, you put kilowatts of power in at the base station to radiate 10 watts of power at the antenna. Not very power efficient. So guess what a quarter of the volume of a major base station is when installed here in Stockholm? Yes, refrigeration and cooling. Right, because all of those watts go somewhere. And since they're not getting radiated out as RF energy, it turns into heat. And so you actually have to put a cooling system in to take away all of this heat. And all of that takes electrical power. So the electrical power consumption of base stations is a big issue today. What else? Okay, how do we get from the base station back into our BSC? Yes? So if we use a cord, so we have a wire, where's the problem? We may have to excavate, put the wire in, and all of that. The biggest problem is if we have a base station that has an aggregate data rate of, let's say, 10 megabits per second, where's the problem? The backhaul now becomes very expensive, right? Because if we don't have fiber there, we've got a problem because we don't have 10 megabits per second easily on both uplink and downlink for ADSL to send it across our normal copper pairs, right? So it becomes very expensive. What happens if you're not the incumbent fixed network operator? Right? If you look at how much the fixed network operator wants to run wires to your base station. So therefore, they use lots of times microwave backhauls. Now, how many of you have a 54 megabit per second wireless LAN access point at home? Okay. How many of you have 54 megabit per second or greater network connectivity from your home into the infrastructure? One. Not many, right? So we've got a bottleneck. We've got lots of bandwidth now peering between the mobile device and the base station, but then we've got this problem between the base station and the rest of the network. And today that's becoming, besides electrical power, the big bottleneck in putting more base stations out. Worse is the fact that when we put in these base stations in small areas, so the range they have to cover is shorter, we decrease our power, but we can now support higher data rates. Yes, which makes our backhaul problem even bigger, right? So until we get fiber to the curb or fiber at least to the neighborhood, backhaul is going to be a very big problem about rolling out lots more access points. And of course, then we can have various sorts of features, call waiting, call forwarding, all of these sorts of, and as he mentioned, the wonderful value of caller line ID, if you think it has value. GSM Phase 2 introduced high-speed circuit switch data and GPRS. High-speed circuit switch data basically just bonded together multiple channels. The bad problem was in the original devices, the time between transmitting and receiving was purposely made 3 time slots apart so that one device could work with one antenna, both transmitting and receiving. But as soon as you started to use more time slots, the problem was that these devices could no longer work. And so multi-slot systems were delayed. HSCSD is basically simply adds an interworking function here, and now we could send high-speed data off to other places. GPS, a true packet system used based on TCP/IP, or X25, it's essentially a slight twist on mobile IP. The peak data rates could be quite high and they could be asymmetric. So I could have 4 times the download capacity as my upload rate. And then by changing the way I encode the data in the time slot, I could get even higher rates, and that's what Edge does. GPRS introduced 2 different new nodes into the system. A serving GPRS support node called an SGSN and a gateway GPRS node called a GGSN. And what did those do? That meant at the BSC, I separated my circuit switch data, which goes to the MSC, from the packet switch data that goes to the SGSN, which basically acts like a router. I put the various SGSNs together and I have a gateway from them to other networks. Voila, off we go. It's really straightforward. The gateway and the SGSNs need to be able to talk to these various databases. In particular, the GGSN needs to be able to talk to the HLR and VLR because we need to be able to, when a packet arrives, know where to send it to. Now, surprisingly, we can even interconnect a bunch of GPS networks together via interconnecting them, since after all, they're just packet networks. And GPRS supports a number of different coding schemes that supported different amounts of robustness and different data rates, et cetera. You can read all about it. Now, when we start up tomorrow, we'll talk about, and I'm sorry to say it, 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. unstructured supplementary data service. And just like SMS, USSD was built into GSM in the beginning, and it is a data service. But we'll see some of its features tomorrow. So we'll stop here today and ask any questions. No questions? Okay, go for it. Have fun. Have a good evening.
Excuse me. I just have one question.